Support for WMNF comes from our members and the Stras Center, presenting the National Geographic Live Multimedia Speaker Series. The next installment is Life, the Unfolding Story with Franz Lanting, wildlife photographer, Tuesday, February 21st at 7 p.m. More at strascenter.org or 813-229-STAR. Thanks, too, to this amazing community for believing in community radio. You helped WMNF raise around $100,000, but we haven't reached our goal of $120,000. It's not too late to help. Please give online at WMNF.org or call 813-238-8001. And thanks. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to bring you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with Jason Winograd, a nationally known expert on no-kill, speaking in Tampa this Saturday, and founder and executive director of the No-Kill Advocacy Center. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is J.J. Cale with his version of Old Blue here on Talking Animals.
He was a good dog too. Blue chased the possum up a hollow limb. Possum won, got the best of him. Bye, bye, Blue. You good dog, you. Bye, bye, Blue. You good dog, you. Blue, he died and he died so hard. He shook the ground in my backyard. We lowered him down with a golden chain. Every lake we called his name. Bye, bye, Blue. You good dog, you. Bye, bye, Blue. You good dog, you. Good old hound, you could hear him holler 4 miles around. When I get to heaven, first thing I'll do, I'll grab my horn and call on Blue. Bye, bye, Blue. You good dog, you. Bye, bye, Blue. You good dog.
J.J. Cale with his version of Old Blue, an animal song indeed, to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name is Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Nathan Winograd, a nationally known author, speaker, and founder executive director of the No-Kill Advocacy Center. We'll be speaking in Tampa this Saturday on the no-kill topic at the Save 90 conference. We'll find out about the conference, which takes its name from studies indicating that 90% of animals entering shelters are healthy and adoptable. And a lot more about no-kill, and Nathan Winograd joins us in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.com. www.animalcomedy.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to see Christine Levin at the Capitol Theater in Clearwater on February 12th. And we'll speak briefly later in the show with Jamie Burley, wife of Mark Burley, the newly signed all-star pitcher with the Miami Marlins. The Burley family has four dogs, including a pit bull named Slater, and decided not to move to Miami area or county because Miami-Dade has a discriminatory law against pit bulls, and Slater would not be legally allowed to live with them. So the Burleys are now speaking against breed discrimination laws and in favor of bills to repeal those laws in Miami-Dade. So we'll talk with Jamie Burley later in the show. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon, produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item, you may have heard this, people have been asking me questions in recent weeks, and after some careful consideration, we've decided we won't be producing another Talking Animals Festival this spring. We are considering ways to reconfigure the festival, so if we relaunch the fest, we may produce the new version in fall, or maybe even hold off till 2013. But in the meantime, we plan to present one of the most popular elements of the festival, upwards of 10 great bands from the Tampa Bay area performing animal songs. So the Talking Animals Music Night will be held March 31st at New World Brewery, featuring a musically diverse slate of bands, including Sons of Hippies, Johnny Cakes and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypso, Rebecca Pulley, Ricky Wilcox and the Moonsnakes, and Sunset Bridge. More bands will be announced in the coming days as they are confirmed. Tickets will be incredibly reasonable, if I do say so myself, and I do. $8 in advance, $10 at the door, in this benefit show for Dubbing Up. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll keep you posted on other details, other bands, as we move along here. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story. Because sometimes stopping animal cruelty really does begin at home, or at least a house or two over. So I'll not give you all the details, just because it'd be kind of a long story. But it's sort of a disturbing experience I had last Wednesday afternoon. So after I left here, I live on the other side of the state, as a lot of listeners know. So it's a long day, it's a long drive. But anyway, so I got back there, and where I live, part of the reason I live so far away is it's a great setup. It's sort of a slightly rural thing, a lot of horses, a lot of animals, people sort of just do their own thing, and it's really great, and we love it. So and the people who live next door have a dressage up kind of situation, lots of horses, training, other things, whatever you think of dressage. These are just great, great people. It's an Australian mother, daughter. The mother is probably early, mid-70s and tough as nails. And anyway, so that kind of is a little bit of backdrop. So I get back. I've just done a few things, got back from here, and I get a frantic call on my cell phone from the mom, who, again, tough as nails, nothing ever fazes this woman, and she sounded completely freaked out. So she's saying something about a dog caught in a trap, and the dog might be dying. They need somebody with strength. Can I come right away? So I drop what I'm doing, obviously, go right over to, she says, the house next to their house. And sure enough, I climb over the fence to where I can hear that that's where they are. And there is a dog. I don't know whose dog it is when I first get there. And he's got a steel trap around his neck. Like a bear trap, I guess, if it would be a little bit smaller. And if you have access now or later to your computer, I did put one picture of this trap on the Talking Animals Facebook page. Anyway, so, but you couldn't, like, get this dog free from the trap. The daughter was there trying to free the dog, and I tried to free, and the trap was just such that you could not release this dog. And the dog had been, just making out these incredible screams. And it was obviously a really traumatic experience. So I just said, wire cutters aren't going to get through this. We need a hacksaw. And so, people were scurrying for that. And long story short, they finally did bring a hacksaw. I did, saw through the trap and freed the dog. And the dog apparently is okay. And I guess these people have chickens. I was so traumatized, I didn't really pay attention to anything except the dog and the trap. But I guess where we were at this time was where these people have chickens. And I guess they had set a trap because they didn't want the raccoons to come get the chickens. So meanwhile, it turns out it was their own dog that was caught in this trap that, again, if we hadn't freed this dog by, you know, another minute or so, I think we would have lost him. He turned out, I guess, to be okay, not physically injured near as we can tell, and I'm sure traumatized as we all were by this. But anyway, it's just incredible. And then I spoke to the animal control guy, to follow up, and that was almost more incredible. I mean, he issued some sort of citation, a slap on the wrist, and for not using a more humane trap, and nothing really happens. I mean, if they called out there again and there's another issue, there'd be like a $100 penalty, I think. And anyway, it's just shocking, but it's just, I guess if it's worth the time that I just gave it, it's just because it's another sort of a slice of how sometimes, you know, laws to protect animals are weak, and or enforcement of them is weak. And it was a wild story. Obviously, I'm still recovering, and luckily, more importantly, the dog has largely recovered. So anyway, all right, on to more official news items. But on a related note, found this from Montana. Another cat lost its leg this week after getting caught in a possibly illegal animal trap. On Thursday, a cat named George was found on Wilson Butte Road with its leg caught in a steel trap. A Good Samaritan turned George into the Great Falls Animal Shelter. His leg was broken by the trap and had to be amputated this morning. On Wednesday, a cat named Dewey had its leg amputated after getting caught in a trap on January 19th. Dewey's leg was shattered, and because of the sub-zero temperatures that week, it was frozen to the trap. All right, also on my side of the state, this is from the Miami Herald. For the first time, scientists have put numbers to the toll Burmese pythons have had on native wildlife in the Everglades. But one word can sum it up. Carnage. In the decades since the gigantic constrictor started showing up in significant numbers, mammals once common in Everglades National Park have declined dramatically, according to a study published online Monday in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. The study, based on night field surveys conducted over 10 years, found three animals had all but disappeared. Possum sightings fell 98.9%. Raccoons, once so abundant, park managers warned visitors to safeguard food from roaming groups of the wily thieves, dropped 99.3%. Marsh rabbits, brown bunnies, frequently seen foraging along roads in the pre-python pass, didn't appear at all. Observations of bobcats, foxes, and deer also fell precipitously. Quote, we started the study saying, man, it appears we're not seeing many mammals, said Michael Dorcas, a biology professor at Davidson College in North Carolina and the study's lead author. When we actually did the calculations, we were astonished by the magnitude of the declines. The study suggests a near collapse of mammal populations in the park and points to the python as prime suspect. All right, back locally, and of course we'll be getting much more into this momentarily when Nathan Winograd joins us, but just want to remind you first that he will be speaking this Saturday, February 4th, in Tampa at the West Shore Marriott, and conference called Save 90, again, so-called because studies show that 90% of animals entering shelters are healthy and adoptable, and Nathan, again, as we'll find out more, is a author, animal advocate, but longtime expert in the area of no-kill. And so if you want to find out more about this, beyond the conversation we'll have shortly, you can go to Save 90, the numeral 90, save90.org. Group of conservationists and American Indian tribes are suing over the Navy's expanded use of sonar in training exercises off the Washington, Oregon, and California coast, saying the noise can harass and kill whales and other marine life. In a lawsuit being filed, I think tomorrow, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Earth Justice, and other groups claim the National Marine Fisheries Service was wrong to approve the Navy's expanded training plan. They say regulators should have considered the effects repeated sonar use can have on those species. The groups want restrictions on where and when the Navy can conduct sonar and other loud activities to protect orcas, humpbacks, and other marine mammals. Instead, the Navy is only required to look around and see if whales are present before they conduct the training. Yes, emphasis mine. Also coming up locally on the horizon here on February 11th at the Shops at Wiregrass will be the first annual My Furry Valentine with 60 local animal rescue groups, vendors, and more. So again, Saturday, February 11th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Shops at Wiregrass Mall. Again, adoption the main focus, but it'll be photo contest, vendors, vets, bounce house, etc. So you can find out more at animalbasedcharities.org. So let's, if we have time, we'll come back to some other items. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Todd Glass. He's a comedian I used to manage years ago and a good friend. I mentioned Todd a few weeks ago. In fact, after he came out in an interview on Mark Maron's celebrated podcast, WTF, I'm really happy for Todd. This is a portion of Todd's comedy piece, Biting a Puppy, on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
People are nice deep down. You can tell by the way they treat animals. Most people are nice. Well, most people, not everybody, but most people. You ever see, like, no one walks by a puppy and is like, what's up? No, you see a puppy. You ever see a puppy so cute? I don't know how to say this. You, like, it's so, you want to bite it? I see the tables here tonight that know exactly what I mean. Because they look at each other like, I know what he means. You want to bite it, of course. And other people are like, what? Yeah, you want to bite its cute little face. You want to mush it and squeeze it and just, why is that? Some people go, no, you just pet it. Yeah, no, you pet it doesn't work. Petting it, oh, there, no, you start petting it, and then you're like, hey, you're getting bit. Oh, so cute. My neighbor had a, their dog had a litter of golden retriever puppies. Oh, my God. There was 6-week-old sitting in the whelping box, and one tried to scratch itself, and it fell over. I'm like, that's it, I'm eating you. You're too cute. It had a cute little...
All right. That's Todd Glass with a portion of a piece called Biting a Puppy. Taken from his album Thin Pig. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Nathan Weinograd. As I noted earlier, Nathan is a nationally known author, speaker, and founder executive director of the No Kill Advocacy Center. His expertise in the sheltering world derives in no small measure from hands-on experience. He was director of operations for the San Francisco SPCA, as well as executive director of the Tompkins County SPCA in New York. The author of 5 books, including Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation, and The No-Kill Revolution in America. Weinograd, as we mentioned, will be speaking in Tampa this Saturday, February 4th, on the no-kill topic at the Save 90 Conference. More on that at save90.org. With a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Nathan Weinograd to Talking Animals. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us. And I feel like we have a lot to cover. But first, to have a conversation, I think that's truly effective and illuminating for all parties, including the array of folks who may be listening and may not be as steeped in this. I think it's wise just to build from a pretty fundamental base. So let's literally just start right at the beginning and say, what is no kill? What exactly do we mean when we use that term?
Well, the primary goal of the movement is to, return the term euthanasia to its dictionary definition. What we're trying to do is to end the killing of healthy and treatable animals in U.S. shelters. And the good news is that it's not just a theoretical discussion. And the even better news is we're talking about most of the animals that come in. There are communities right now across the United States that are saving upwards of 95, 96, even 97% of all the animals. Unfortunately, Duncan, there's always going to be a small percentage of animals who are truly irremediably suffering or hopelessly ill or injured, or tragically in the case of dogs, truly vicious with a poor prognosis for rehabilitation. But for 95% of those or so that don't meet that definition, the message we're bringing to Tampa this weekend is that we can save them, we can find them homes, and in more and more communities, that's exactly what we're doing.
All right. Well, I clearly want to delve into that, and of course, what's going on this Saturday more. But let's find out a little bit more about you, and sort of take us back, if you will, to the period of life when you were Nathan Weinograd, practicing attorney. I mean, Stanford Law School, corporate attorney. You know, could have probably written your own ticket for a fabulous, successful law career, but that's, you know, that's not what you chose. That's not the direction you decided to pursue. So maybe you could trace the path from, you know, what might have been and the choices you made to, for example, your job at the San Francisco SPCA. What drew you in that direction and why?
Well, Duncan, my father-in-law says I'm the only person he's ever met whose goal in life seems to be a smaller and smaller office and smaller paycheck, and that's because my clients, you know, the dogs and cats entering shelters, don't have deep pockets. But it's been a labor of love, and I'm glad it's the direction I took. It actually started when I was a law student at Stanford. There were roughly 500 cats that made their home on the Stanford University campus, and I was part of a group called the Stanford Cat Network that took care of them, that fed them every day, that built them shelters, and for the friendly ones, found them homes. And for me, it was really where I got my wake-up call about what the reality was like for animals entering shelters. You know, the local shelter thought that the cats should be rounded up and killed because they were unsocial and therefore not adoption candidates. Some of the large national organizations also felt that. And for me, I realized that a lot of our nation's shelters are places where animals are killed even when those animals aren't suffering. So rather than pursue as you mentioned, and as my father-in-law likes to quip, a lucrative law career, after a short stint as a district attorney and a small stint in corporate law, I went to work for the San Francisco SPCA at a time when it just achieved a monumental, a monumental goal, becoming the first city in the United States to end the killing of healthy dogs and cats entering city shelters. And I wanted to take it a step further. And when I went to run animal control in upstate New York, we became the first community in the nation not just to end the killing of healthy dogs and cats, but to end the killing of all savable animals. And that included the rabbits and hamsters and gerbils and other small animals that came into the shelter. And it included those that came in, you know, sick, injured, unweaned, and traumatized. It didn't matter if they were deaf or blind or missing limbs. We found them a home, and ultimately achieved a save rate of about 93%. And the good news is that since that time, and since founding the No Kill Advocacy Center, we've managed to increase that success to about 30 communities nationwide.
Wow. Okay. Well, a couple things. First, Nathan, I guess I should confess that your father-in-law and I are in cahoots to tease you about not pursuing your lucrative law career. But secondly, I want to really sort of figure out, like, right off the bat, I mean, when you took that first job, for example, with the San Francisco SPCA, I mean, did you already have kind of like a vision, a thought, like, hey, I'm not sure exactly how this is going to play out, but I think I can really kind of change things. I can really kind of maybe, shake things up if I, get to implement my ideas, or did you have kind of those well-formed ideas that early?
I did not. I mean, one of the things that has allowed me to, be successful in this field and help others be successful. Well, first of all, I went to work for a man who was sort of pioneering a lot of the programs that have become part of what I like to call the no-kill equation, the comprehensive implementation of a core set of programs that have allowed shelters to eliminate the killing nationwide. But the reality was that I came into sheltering with very little background. I was a volunteer board member for a small humane society near Stanford, the Palo Alto Humane Society, but for the most part, I didn't have experience. And unfortunately, in sheltering, prior experience often means a history of killing. And it means a set mindset of, well, this is the way we've always done it. This is the way we're always going to do it, even if the way we've always done it, again, means, failure time and time again when we rob animals of their lives. And so I think part of not having that experience and part of having the legal training is I had a goal. And I wasn't sure how we were going to get to the goal. And, back then there wasn't a playbook. There no communities had achieved no kill. No kill was a theoretical ideal that would, that we hoped to accomplish sometime in the future. And some of the programs we tried were incredible successes, and they've continued to be successes. And some of the programs that we tried were spectacular failures. But the good news was we always looked to see if we were achieving the results we wanted. We didn't keep programs just because we've always had those programs. Our goal was to end the killing, and we were working our way to it. Now that we discovered the keys to ending the killing, the good news is that, you know, that sort of trial and error period could be a thing of the past if communities implemented with a degree of rigor the same programs that have allowed us to end the killing in those communities nationwide, they too can be successful. And my hope is that, you know, the leadership in Hillsborough County, attends, is listening, and follows through.
All right. Well, let's let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with no-kill expert Nathan Weinograd, who will be speaking on that very topic at a conference in Tampa this Saturday entitled Save 90. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Nathan a question, offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So in your last comment, you hit on a number of important points, but one of them to me kind of gets to what for me is sort of the $64,000 question, or at least one of them in this realm, which is, why is no kill so polarizing? I mean, the positions are so passionate on both sides, and in a, you know, sort of know thy enemy way, I mean, you must understand, even if you don't agree or embrace, you know, the other side. Can maybe you could just outline the objections held by those who clearly oppose no-kill in a lot of areas. I mean, is it based strictly on economics? You mentioned earlier we've always done it this way. I'm sure there must be a lot of that. But what all is going on here?
Well, I think part of the problem is, you know, in sheltering, we've always fallen back on certain cliches. And hid behind them. So, there has been shelter directors who are, in shelters that are still killing the bulk of their occupants, you know, rely on things like suggesting that it's not their fault, that it's the irresponsible public's fault for failing to spay neuter, or they'll suggest there's just simply not the homes available and they have no choice, but to kill. And what we are doing in the no-kill movement is trying to bring accountability to a movement that traditionally has had essentially a free ride. So as long as they lamented the killing, as long as they pointed the finger of blame to the quote-unquote irresponsible public, then nobody questioned, well, is the volume of killing really necessary, or can you save more lives? Is there something the shelter should be doing differently, the old adage, physician heal thyself, in order to reduce the volume of killing and eliminate it entirely? And of course, they've long suggested that no kill was, a passing daydream, and not realistic and certainly not possible. And with the growing success of the movement, and with advocates in particular communities looking at the success, say in Austin, Texas, or Reno, Nevada, or my community in Tompkins County, New York, and Marquette, Michigan, and Shelby County, Kentucky, and all those communities that have ended the killing of healthy and treatable animals. They're asking if they can do it there, why can't we do it here in our community? And I think that has put shelter directors on the defensive. And unfortunately, like any profession, when when you're told the way you have been doing it is wrong, and that there's this new, more progressive, innovative model that allows us to engage in animal control sheltering in a more humane way, unfortunately, people tend to get defensive, and people tend to get and institutions tend to get bureaucratic, and they close off. And rather than embrace this new philosophy, they lash out, and unfortunately, that's what we're seeing around the country. But the arguments, Duncan, are becoming more and more untenable the more and more success we have in communities across the nation.
Well, absolutely, because I mean, the thing is, I realize this is slightly absurdist, but by design to make a point, it's like it's hard to imagine somebody sitting across from you and saying, okay, here's why I'm for continuing to kill the animals at the high rate that we've been doing. I mean, so obviously they don't do that, but like you say, there's various last, I mean, just as kind of an interesting example, just because it's very close to home, I did what I normally do. I put a little blurb about, your then sort of forthcoming interview on the radio station website. And, it's more detailed than some because I recycle other email blasts and Facebook posts and whatever. But anyway, it's not really a blog post. It's just like, hey, here's who's coming to the show. But there is a way you can leave comments, and it almost never happens. So a few days ago, Here's a comment. Nathan Winograd's experience in sheltering covers no more than 10,000 animals, hardly the numbers that make him an expert. And I, in the headline, I called you an expert. He condemns the very agencies that are on the front lines of animal cruelty, like HSUS and the ASPCA. And while Winograd is giving interviews to the likes of Rick Berman, who condemns HSUS, Berman, who supports commercial breeding dogs, a.k.a. puppy mills, Berman, who supports continued cruelty in agribusiness. Winograd is not what he appears to be. Do your research on him, and you will probably want to put him on the next train to Clarksville. So I wrote a very nice, milquetoasty response to that, sort of, because I just thought that was just full of non sequiturs, and I didn't get it, but I laid out some points, and I even invited that person, if they wanted to speak on the air, that I'd be happy to, welcome that viewpoint just to explore it further. And of course, I didn't hear anything further, and I got some other comments from saying, please don't give this person airtime when you're talking to Nathan. But I mean, it's just an example, just a very small slice right here of people like, I guess if this is a polarizing issue, of course, that inherently makes you a polarizing figure.
Well, it's not really a polarizing issue to the American public. Here's the deal, Duncan, and it's really mind-boggling in some ways. If you were to stop 100 people on the street and say, look, there are communities across the country that have ended the killing of healthy and treatable animals. They are saving 95% of the dogs and cats and rabbits and other animals that enter shelters, and it's costing them no more money to do it, and they're having very quick success. So there was a time, for example, in Reno, Nevada, where there were two staff members whose job it was literally to kill animals from the moment they got there to the moment they clocked out at the end. Every day they would fill 15 barrels full of dead bodies. Every night those barrels would be emptied, and they'd fill them up again the next day. That no longer happens. Reno, Nevada, despite taking in over twice the number per capita than, say, Hillsborough County, has ended the killing of healthy and treatable animals, and there was no budget increase. And now, if they can do it in Reno, would you want that in your community? 100% of the people you surveyed would find nothing controversial about that. Of course, if we can save the animals, that's what we should do. Saving lives is only controversial within the movement, within the old guard of shelter directors who have been at it for 10, 15, and 20 years and are finally being held accountable. It's only controversial to people who have a vested interest in the status quo. And actually, that's actually positive and good news, because unlike other social movements of the past, we don't have to win the hearts and minds of the American people. We don't have to convince them that this is a better way to go. As the civil rights movement or the suffrage movement or any of the other social movements of the past. And that is good news. Our fight is not against the many. It's against the few. And unfortunately, those few have had a free ride in sheltering for 50 years and now are accusing me of a morally darker vision, even though all I'm asking is that we end the systematic killing of animals in shelters, because we've discovered how to stop it, and in more and more communities, that's exactly what we have done.
So, okay, Nathan. Well, so let's then look at this. What elements are necessary to shift a shelter toward a no-kill operation? I mean, how gradual does the transformation to be truly effective, what's the best way to do that given the culture and what has happened in your experience, or also in your experience, do certain aspects really need to be implemented quickly, if not dramatically, to truly take hold?
Yeah, actually the latter. I mean, the reality is if you look at, underage neonatal kittens and puppies that need supplemental bottle feeding around the clock, how are you going to save them without a volunteer-based foster care program? In the case of, say, dogs that come in traumatized, how are you going to save them without a behavior rehabilitation program? In the case of unsocial wild or feral cats, how are you going to save them without a neutering and re-release program? So what we found is that there are certain categories of animals that enter shelters across the country, and we have developed a comprehensive response to save those animals. And all told, there are 10 different programs that every shelter needs to implement, and they need to implement them comprehensively. They include that neuter-release program for the feral cats, a working relationship with rescue groups, foster care, comprehensive adoption programs, you know, helping people overcome the medical and behavior and environmental conditions that might cause them to surrender their animals through a, you know, a pet retention program, a medical and behavior rehabilitation, and more. And what we found is that when shelters comprehensively implement those kinds of programs, you know, all together into, you know, one large cohesive whole, which we call the no-kill equation, they actually, you know, the number of animals, the percentage of animals killed actually plummets. And we've seen communities go from incredible high rates of killing to reducing killing not 5% a year or 10% of the year, but on the order of 50 to 75% in 1 year, and really turn their electrify their communities, turn the community on its head and walk away very quickly with a community shelter that is the very dictionary definition of a shelter. You know, a temporary way station where animals go until they find loving new homes, or they get, reunited with their families out looking for them. That's the vision that we've seen in other communities, and that's the vision we hope for Hillsborough County, Florida, and elsewhere.
All right, cool. I have a few more questions, but let's get some other folks involved here. There, we got a caller here that's been holding. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Nathan Winograd.
Hi.
Hi, it's you.
Okay. I wanted to say, first of all, this whole no-kill thing, I think it's a wonderful big step in the right direction.
Okay.
So I'm not trying to put that whole movement down, but there are problems with it. I live in Manatee County, and they're trying to implement this now. They're starting all their steps, and they are doing a lot better than they used to do. However, I am sitting here in the country now, the proud owner of six dogs that... I'm really is a lot of dogs for me. One is a pit bull, although he is not vicious, but he hates one of my male dogs, which creates a problem. Male dogs can do that, not because they're pit bulls, because they're males.
Mm-hmm.
And so what has happened is when I live in the country, so when these dogs have been dumped out, I have sought help from different organizations, every organization I could find in the state of Florida, as a matter of fact, to place these dogs, and I can get no help now from these organizations. I can get no help from anybody, not from the Humane Society. So I'm left as an individual totally on my own, and the reason for this is because now the Humane Society, the pounds, they're jamming all these private organizations up with dogs, and there's still this excess, and then this excess just goes to the public. I don't know what would happen to these dogs if I weren't taking care of them and feeding them, because they had been just dumped on the road. And I think we're going to have a lot more dumping on the road because of this, because you cannot find a place to put your dog now.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, and let's let Nathan respond to that. Thanks so much for your call.
Well, I don't see that as a problem with the no-kill philosophy. I mean, the no-kill philosophy and the way it's been implemented in communities across the country have ended the killing. It's almost, I mean, first of all, bless her for taking responsibility for those dogs.
Sure.
But what she should have is a shelter in her community where she can take those dogs without fear that they're going to be killed. I mean, that is the vision that, that I want for the nation. You know, when you are in Austin, Texas, for example, or if she lived in Austin, Texas, there is the open admission municipal shelter where she would have a right to bring those dogs, and the good news is the dogs would not be killed. That is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about rescue groups that don't return phone calls, and I'm certainly not talking about humane societies that, raise the lion's share of the public's philanthropic generosity for animal issues and yet turn people away. So the problem is that the shelters in her community haven't fully implemented, the no-kill equation model of shelter, because if they had, if say, she was in Reno, Nevada, or if she was in Austin, Texas, or Shelby County, Kentucky, or any of the other communities where there is an open admission animal control shelter that wouldn't kill those dogs, she wouldn't have that call. So, Manatee County is a community in transition. The good news is, you know, where in the past 6 out of 10 dogs were killed, now and cats, now 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10 are being saved. They're just not there yet, and that is not something that should result in a complete condemnation of the no-kill philosophy, because of those 8 out of 10 animals that are being saved, whereas half of them would have been killed in the past, have a very different viewpoint of what they're trying to do.
Sure, and like you say, when a facility or an area is in transition, that's probably tricky. But it sounds like already, as you're pointing out, the numbers of Manatee County are already on their way to being almost reversed. It sounds like.
Yeah. And what's exciting, I mean, just to give you another example, when I was in upstate New York, and we had ended the killing of animals in our community, we were the animal control shelter. So if people found animals in Tompkins County, they would bring them to us, and we would have to take them. And I remember one woman said to me, "I found this cat, and I'm bringing him to you." And she said, "You know, in the past, I would have kept this cat because I would have known that if I brought him to you, not while I was there, but to this facility, the animal would have been killed. And I already have plenty of cats at home, and now I want to give those animals to you so that you can save them." And actually, that's positive. And that's the kind of environment that I think they're trying to create in Manatee County, and we're trying to create in other communities across the country.
All right, Nathan. Well, gosh, we're sort of hurtling towards being out of time, but we've got emailers, we've got callers. Let me quickly read one of the emailers. The subject line says, "This guest is fantastic," with four exclamation marks. "Thank you for your great work. Please keep spreading the word about no kill and the programs that need to be implemented. Do you have pets yourself?" Which you kind of just answered there in your message. Sound like there's plenty of cats and maybe dogs too. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Nathan Weinegrad.
Yes, this is Marilyn Weaver. Am I on?
Yes, you are, Marilyn. Go ahead, please.
Okay.
Turn your sound, your computer or your radio down, or you'll get confused again.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
I just did. Yes, in reference to this lady that just spoke, I understand where she's coming from. However, one of the keys to this is to expand low-cost spay-neuter to reduce the population, and this will help immediately in what she is running into by having to take in more animals, because during transition you can't get everything going all at once. So I think a very key component is somehow we have to really set up lots more low-cost spay-neuter clinics, or maybe get the vets to help us with some of this stuff also. And, of course, maybe we need to look into the breeders and maybe look at some restrictions in the amount of animals they can produce, so that it will address this woman's concerns, because then she won't have to rescue as many dogs. What do you think about that, Nathan?
Well, if you actually go to the No Kill Advocacy Center's website at nokilladvocacycenter.org and look at all the programs and services of the No Kill Equation, right up there, at number one or number two is high volume, low cost spay neuter. And for so long this movement has talked about how the public's irresponsible and they won't spay neuter. And actually, what we found is that the primary barrier to spay neuter is cost. For those in the bottom 15% of the economic ladder, it really is a significant undertaking for them, not just the cost of the neutering, but often they have to pay a veterinary office visit, they have to do pre-surgical blood work, some vets won't spay neuter unless the animal's fully vaccinated, and that can add up. And so what we did in San Francisco, for example, is we offered spay neuter for free to any San Francisco resident. It didn't matter how much money they made. It didn't matter. We just wanted to eliminate all the obstacles. You didn't even have to make an appointment. Just show up at our clinic, drop off your animal in the morning. We'd sterilize the animal, and you can pick the animal up at the end of the day. And what we found was that the number of people who actually got their animals altered skyrocketed, and we actually cut intakes in half. Now, in Hillsborough County, for example, they're taking in about 21,000 animals a year, and if they did the volume of surgery that we did in San Francisco, imagine how many more lives, how easier the job would be if they were only taking in, say, 10,000 animals a year. So it's definitely a core program of the no-kill equation, but what I want to caution is we can't just keep talking about spay-neuter because spay-neuter won't help those animals already in the shelter. What they need is foster care. They need rescue groups. They need comprehensive adoption program. They need medical and behavior rehabilitation. So one thing that I do not agree with is that we quote unquote have to continue killing until the effects of spay neuter are seen. It's important, but it is not a prerequisite to saving lives.
Oh, I agree with you on that.
Thank you for your call, Marilyn. We got a scoop. We're just about out of time, but thank you again for your call. All right, Nathan. Well, gosh, let me quickly at least hit a couple of websites here and see if we have maybe one more quick minute here. But, Nathan's, website is simply nathanweinograd.com. It's W-I-N-O-G-R-A-D. And then, as he alluded to, the No Kill Advocacy Center is simply nokilladvocacycenter.org. And then for this, Saturday's, conference, again, it's, this Saturday, February 4th. At the West Shore Marriott, and that event is called Save 90, so the website there is save90.org. And we have literally probably less than a minute here, Nathan, but I'm just curious if you could quickly address this, because I felt this was sort of discouraging and the possibility of heading the other direction. Maybe you could just very, very briefly address the situation with sort of the Tom Hayden, Jerry Brown thing that seems to be pending at the moment.
Well, you know, California pioneered shelter reform legislation that, had shelters actually orient themselves towards life-saving rather than killing, and that was back in 1998. And in just 1 year, we reduced the killing by nearly 250,000 dogs and cats. Unfortunately, our current governor wants to roll back the clock 15 years, saying that he wants to return sheltering to local control by repealing that law. And what we have seen is that local control allows shelters to do what they want and to, in fact, ignore what's in the best interest of animals and kill them needlessly. And we've already sort of seen that happen since 2009 in California, and the number of dogs and cats and other animals killed has been increasing. So we've put out a call to animal lovers, not just in California, but across the country, to contact Governor Jerry Brown and to tell them to maintain those protections and state law, because in the end, not only is it more cost-effective to save lives rather than kill them, but it will mean a life and death difference for hundreds of thousands of animals. And if people are interested in getting involved in that, they can just go to nathanweinograd.com, read the blog post, and contact the governor off the website.
All right. Well, yeah, let's hope Governor Brown is listening. So, Nathan, thank you very, very much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and we'll look forward to your talk on Saturday right here in Tampa.
Thank you so much, Duncan. It was my pleasure.
All right, great. Thank you. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. There'll be a prize, a pair of tickets to see Christine Lavin at the Capitol Theater in Clearwater on February 12th. To the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune. In a moment, we'll chat with Jamie Burley about her family's experience with breed discrimination laws in Miami-Dade County and their efforts to repeal those laws. Right now, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Take any guesses that we might have off the air, because we want to get right to Jamie Burley. So, Jamie Burley, are you there? Good morning, and welcome to Talking Animals.
Good morning. I'm here. How are you guys?
We're doing really, really well. Thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals today. So let's sort of briefly recount your experience. So basically, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the show, but for those who may have tuned in later, your husband is Mark Burley, the all-star pitcher who recently signed with the Miami Marlins. So obviously you're needing to move to near where the team plays. So maybe you could sort of just pick up the story from there and kind of what happened and, you know, your family of dogs, et cetera.
When we first started realizing that we weren't going to be with the White Sox and we knew the Marlins was one of the front runners, like everyone kept saying, well, you know, you can't live in Miami with having a pit bull. And so we started looking at our other options right away, because if there was nowhere to live with him, then obviously we wouldn't go there. So then we realized that Broward County was okay and it was still an okay commute. And so when we started looking out there for houses, even then, we ran into homeowners associations that didn't allow pit bulls, literally like across the road from a different subdivision that we looked in. So it did get kind of complicated, but we worked it out.
And so had you had any kind of experience? Okay, first of all, I guess we should cover that you guys have four dogs, right? And one of those is Slater, the pit bull. And had you guys encountered any, you know, anything else like near where you live now, or, you know, any sort of breed discrimination laws in and around the area that you have been living?
No, in neighboring counties, they do have it, and I've tried to help with trying to lift that, but where we live, per se, no. We also did run into that with our homeowners insurance, too, so I guess we've had a little bit of discrimination issues, but as far as where we actually were living, this was the first time.
So you've, you know, basically decided, okay, hey, well, we can't live in Miami-Dade, obviously, because then, you know, Slater wouldn't be with us, and that's not even something to consider. So you went to the next county over, Broward.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, I mean, the thing that I think is really kind of cool and interesting is that rather than just say, okay, well, that's how we solved it, you guys have really been sort of speaking out about the breed discrimination law and trying to repeal it. Maybe you could just sort of talk a little bit. Well, is that Slater or somebody else in the background? That's great.
Started thinking about it even more. Because I started thinking about families that would not have the resources to, you know, look elsewhere to make accommodations if people are transferred to Miami because of their job.
Sure.
And, you know, it's a money issue of trying to commute and find other housing. It's just not feasible. And so I keep thinking, those poor families, what would they do? Because I look at Slater every day and I cannot imagine having to give him up, or even worse, someone taking him from me, based solely on the fact of how he looks. And I know that that happens every day with families, and people have been talking about it. It just isn't being heard. And so Mark and I thought, what better way, because we have a little bit higher platform, to make people talk about it, discuss it. I know not everyone's going to agree whether a pit bull is for them or not, and that's not what we're trying to push. We're trying to push responsible ownership. You should be responsible for your dog regardless of what breed it is. I shouldn't have my Vizsla running around off-leash, just like I shouldn't have my pit bull. And
right.
So we just want to, you know, try to educate people. It's not just a breed across the board. It's about being a responsible owner and letting people choose what kind of dog. As long as they're going to be responsible, they should be able to have whatever breed they want.
And also, too, Jamie, isn't it partly hooked into the idea that it's not just those issues you mentioned, but it's the idea of, you know, inherently discriminating against, well, anything really, but in this case a breed. Hey, it's a pit bull, therefore they cannot live in our county.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just that point alone, I mean, seems to leave out everything else, including, like you say, responsible, you know, behavior of the families, you know, pit bulls being, you know, like any other animal or people, different from, you know, from animal to animal. So it just seems like it's so sweeping.
Yes, it does. And I mean, I understand that the media has made people afraid, and I get that. But I just feel like now we should be kind of past that. Now people need to start educating themselves on, I mean, even if you're not going to look into statistics alone, just look at it from, just like I said, the responsible owner part, and leave it at that. Don't just say because one dog bit that every dog of that breed is going to bite.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's one of the things that's sort of, you know, we're just in that phase, and there's been other dogs over the years, you know, it was German Shepherds, it was Doberman Pinschers, it was this, it was that, at different phases that all were like, oh, these are dangerous dogs, and look at all the bad things. And then there's kind of hysteria that seems to surround that. I mean, there are some legitimate things that happen, absolutely, but as one of our phone callers anonymously pointed out a few months ago, who works for a major newspaper, you know, a lot of times that's just, it gets reported that it's a pit bull, even if they don't know for sure that it is, just because that seems like, you know, the easy thing to say, or just like, hey, well, of course it would be a pit bull, otherwise why would this attack have happened? And that's not necessarily, well, it's not good reporting, but it's not necessarily true.
And yeah, exactly. And I've heard of stories where it's been another breed and the media is not interested.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've been happy to see the last few unfortunate stories that I've even seen. They've put pit bull in quotation marks, which to me, maybe the average person wouldn't think that, but I kind of take that as, leave it to your interpretation whether it was or not. It's, you know,
oh, okay.
Not fact.
Yeah, well, it's subtle, but that's something. So, and the other thing too, you know, that we spoke briefly, obviously, yesterday to arrange this talk today on the air. And one thing you said that really, you know, kind of stuck with me too, that I just think is sort of an important, it's sort of a side point, but it's not unimportant, is that you and Mark have two, it sounds like, really young kids, like toddlers, I think you said.
Yes.
So,
we have two toddlers, and that was one of the, you know, I fell in love with Slater and had no intentions of getting a fourth dog. I don't need a fourth dog with two toddlers. But he has been absolutely amazing with my kids. He's been the easiest addition. My children, literally my daughter at two, always ask for Slater to sleep with her. He's just the most gentle, loving dog. And I feel like what speaks more volumes than seeing a pit bull in a multi-dog household with toddlers.
Right. Well, that might be the perfect place to leave this conversation. But again, thank you and Mark for the sort of PSA and other parts of the campaign and just calling attention to this. Like you say, you have a larger platform than many of us, and hopefully people are listening, and hopefully we'll get this breed discrimination law in Miami-Dade repealed. So thank you again for,
thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Jamie. Take care.
Okay. Thanks. You
Bye-bye.
Too.
All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, February 8th, with another edition of the program. I hope you'll join me then. Also, hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, archives of podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. And we'll catch up with you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals. This is WMNF Tampa. We're having the NPR News presently, and